Welcome to Amplified, a Hermes podcast channel where we discuss the key topics, challenges, and trends shaping the investment landscape. I'm Mitch Resnick, co-head of Hermes Credit and head of credit research. Today's topic for Amplified is global trends in regulation relating to ESG. Now, we know that words like regulation and taxonomy tend to scare people off. Definitely does so at cocktail parties, I can attest to that. But it is something that is extremely important in terms of investment trends. Because these topics are essential to understand in order to identify investment opportunities, we thought it would make sense to water things down a bit, simplify things, to better understand the regulation story so that it makes it a lot more accessible. With me to discuss global trends in ESG regulation is Ingrid Holmes, head of policy and advocacy at Hermes. We promise that we're going to save the bell of the ball taxonomy for the latter part of the podcast and wrap up with why we think all of this makes sense from investment opportunities point of view. So let's kick off. Now, Ingrid, from what I can see across the globe, there is incredible momentum in regulation, but it isn't even across the world. And for example, in some cases, like Europe, momentum is, shall we say, bottoms up. It's coming from investors. In other jurisdictions, it seems to be top down from governments. Governments are driving regulation toward ESG, for example, in the PRC. But in any case, these new rules are being created, and in a way, they're ensuring that there is really no going back in ESG integration or the analysis of ESG factors in the investment process. Effectively, ESG is being codified as mainstream, and as I said, there's no going back. So maybe you could kick off the discussion and give a sense of where we're coming from, where we're headed, and you know, in the various footprints across the globe.
So I think your overview is quite right, Mitch. Both governments and investors are increasingly understanding that it's both the quality as well as the quantity of investment that's going to be important going forward, which is why we're seeing the need to address and respond to issues like climate change and wider ESG factors figuring large amongst both groups. You picked out China and Europe in your introduction. Those are great examples. Those jurisdictions are far out in front of the rest of the field. This is being driven by a need to address quite massive green infrastructure investment gaps. In Europe, we've seen an investment gap of around 180 billion euros a year to 2030 to meet Europe's climate and energy targets. And in China, estimates are around 2 to 3 trillion renminbi per year needed to meet China's ecological civilization goals. So how are the governments responding to that need? Well, they're both taking a common systematic approach to encouraging the market to think longer term to meet these goals by applying an ESG type lens to investment activities.
Okay, so that's Europe, that's China. Maybe we can drill down a little bit of what's going on in the PRC. Is there anything specific that you can point to? And then we can move on to some of the other jurisdictions.
So I think there's been a huge amount of interest in China's leadership. In 2016, they launched a green financial system plan, a comprehensive plan to channel investment into the government's ecological civilization goals. So this included a range of different measures from new green bond standards, green lending standards, and positive incentives from the regulator, the People's Bank of China, to incentivize commercial banks to increase their green lending activity.
I can definitely, you know, see how that manifests itself in the investment world, because we're seeing increasing issuance of green bonds or green loans coming out of the PRC. What about the rest of Asia? Say, for example, in developed Asia, I know, you know, the GPIF is pretty advanced in leading the dialogue there.
Absolutely. So one of my quotes is from the CIO there, Hiro Mizuno, who said, "We don't invest to beat the market because we own the market. It's therefore important that we work to ensure a sustainable global financial system." And I think that reflects very much the sort of bottom-up interest of funds like GPIF in driving market change rather than waiting for regulators. So really embracing this idea of stewardship of capital, not just allocation of capital.
What's interesting about that is that, you know, maybe it's not being codified at the government level, but when you have the largest player in a jurisdiction like Japan that is now even including, from what I've read, ESG integration is one of its principles, how much that is going to lead others. Speaking of asset owners leading the way, what about, you know, what's going on in the U.S. as a final stop on this world tour?
So I think with the election of Trump, there was some concern that the ESG agenda might slow in the US, and quite a flurry of excitement at the issuance of the Department of Labor bulletin on whether it was right for investors to continue to factor ESG considerations into how they invest. But I think what we saw once that bulletin had been analysed in more detail was that some guardrails had been applied, but that ESG was here to stay. So I think we can expect to see a growing number of US investors concerned about how better to respond to climate change and other ESG matters. So the momentum is here to stay, I think.
I think that statement from the Department of Labor was very important, because it basically frees investors from the litigious or legal risk of weaving in ESG integration
Absolutely.
Into the investment process and having some concern that it's in violation of fiduciary responsibility, when in fact it is completely consistent with delivering into fiduciary responsibility. I think that, you know, one thing that surprised me a little bit when we were talking earlier was that I didn't really quite understand or see how much engagement is actually a part of, I don't know if it's rulemakers or advisories, but in fact, engagement, which we, of course, at Hermes see as an important part, an indelible part, in fact, of ESG integration, but engagement is being woven into rule setting.
Absolutely. And I think that's a response to the growing number of stewardship codes we're seeing emerge globally. So there's at least 15 in play in different regions across the globe, as countries as diverse as Bulgaria, Brazil, Japan, the UK and the US. They're not obligatory, but they are increasingly being adopted, as I think both asset owners and asset managers understand the value of actually engaging with investee companies to hopefully unlock the long-term value that comes from addressing, responding to ESG risks and opportunities.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's quite reassuring for us, because ESG integration is essential, you know, from my point of view, in all investment, but of course in credit investment. And part of that ESG integration is engagement. So it's quite reassuring to see that trade associations recognize, you know, engagement as a part of ESG integration.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's the global run on regulation for ESG. As I said in the beginning, you know, for me, it really implies that there's no going back on this, but that's fine in theory. So, but let's talk about what the implications are, and then we'll get to that the bell of the ball taxonomy, and then finally wrap up on investment opportunities. Maybe we can start with the implications for asset managers. You know, what does all this mean for investment companies like us?
So I think we are now starting to see regulators build on the momentum created by the stewardship codes emerging around the world. The EU is definitely leading on this, and there is a growing expectation that asset managers will now disclose how they integrate ESG factors into investment decisions and what positive impact they may have. There's some discussion too about actually how asset managers are remunerated in line with ESG integration. And the idea is really to try to use ESG as a way to drive culture change within the industry and increase the focus on the long term. So this has the potential to be quite transformational.
I think that is entirely consistent with the way the market is going. You know, obviously from our perspective, ESG is mainstream, but if you look at the growth in signatories to the PRI and other associations, this is really going, you know, it's consistent that regulation is matching sort of the trends in the market in general. Now, let's shift to the elephant in the room, taxonomy. And I think let's just begin with, what is a taxonomy? Why is it so important? And then as a segue, we can talk through what's happening in Europe for that and how it can influence other jurisdictions as well.
So I think one of the challenges with mainstreaming sustainability, ESG integration, is not everyone is there yet in understanding what this really is and means. And that's really what the taxonomy is there to do. The taxonomy is simply a classification system setting out the possible universe of sustainable economic activities that will help Europe, because this is a European initiative, transition from our current state of a high carbon economy to the low carbon economy of the future that we need to stabilize the climate to less than a 2 degree global global temperature increase. So it will simply set out the possible universe of economic activities, starting with those that contribute to climate change mitigation. So there are a range. That range could be at the lower ambition end of the spectrum, gas-fired power stations replacing coal-fired power stations because they emit less CO2, the primary gas responsible for driving climate change. But there are much deeper green options available, like solar, wind turbine, which don't emit any greenhouse gases at all. So this will describe all of those activities and really create a common language between businesses, investors and banks to accelerate learning and understanding, which for the vast majority of firms just simply isn't there yet. Now, the interesting part is how this taxonomy is actually used, but we'll come to that in a moment.
Well, I mean, obviously companies are going to have a great deal of interest in this, but maybe you can run through sort of what's Hermes' view on this? This is quite an important piece of regulation because it's pioneering, it will be influential, and setting standards is always a controversial thing to do.
So I think we really like the idea that the taxonomy will exist. It will, as we hope, accelerate learning and understanding in the market, create some consistency of thinking of what is in and out in our future low carbon economy. So it will be useful from that perspective. I think the kind of rigorous process that's been run by the Commission, which is it's an officially endorsed group, will lend credibility and mean that if something useful emerges at the end of this process, those definitions will be adopted in other jurisdictions. China is one obvious example, the UK is another. So that will create some consistency and agreement across what our future needs to look like. We are concerned, however, about how it might be applied if it is used as a basis from which to develop EU green bond standards and green fund labels of the sorts being discussed. In that case, I think our concern is that the Commission only includes in those minimum standards those activities that form part of our future economy. Now, in the transition, the energy transition to get there, there will obviously be winners and losers. And what we'd really like to see is those investment choices left to the market, to the skill of the asset manager to select and understand where value will be created and lost. So we really would like to see that deep green standard and use of the taxonomy emerge at the end of this process.
Yeah, and I think from an investment point of view, we definitely respect what the regulators are pointing us to, but always appreciate as much liberty as we can have in making those investment decisions and not being boxed in any one way or another, being able to assess and price the qualities of any kind of security.
There's another thing to add on this. So one of the other really important conversations happening now amongst prudential regulators, so our central banks and so on, is whether prudential rules, so capital requirements, should be adjusted to reflect the risk of not delivering on our climate change obligations. One of the challenges that the regulators face is having a consistent dialogue around what might contribute or not contribute to that transition. So this taxonomy could underpin that regulatory discussion as well. And that would be particularly important when we think about how banks in future adjust their lending activities. So another important application there.
That is quite meaningful to say the least. Timing, when will the taxonomy be codified? What's the timeline we're looking at?
In terms of timing for when this taxonomy becomes codified in law, I think there was a hope that this would be in place by May this year. We expect the regulation that would give the taxonomy its legal identity will now be delayed. The primary concern is amongst member state governments who understand that this taxonomy really steps into the breach, the uncertainty left by the fact there are no climate and energy targets beyond 2030. So this taxonomy will help describe that and therefore has deep political implications for where capital may or may not flow in terms of the economic activities in those economies. So they want to wait until the first draft of this taxonomy is ready, which should be late 2019, and then move forward with the regulation at that point.
I think delay would make sense if that happens. There are going to be a lot of cooks in the kitchen here as that's being drafted.
Yeah.
That is a great segue to where we're going to wrap up, which is, what does this all mean from an investment landscape, investment opportunity point of view? You know, let's start with your perspective from the policy side, and I can talk a little bit about from my perspective from the investment side.
So I think notions of value are changing in the market as policymakers require investors to consider a wider range of risks and opportunities, so not just financial risks, in their investment decisions, and disclose to their clients and the regulator how they do this. I think this is absolutely needed as the economy faces major structural changes. Some of these are policy-led, some of them will be about weather events, some of them are consumer-led, but it's issues like climate change, but also artificial intelligence, increased automation, growing inequality, which is really changing notions of essential infrastructure and so on. So from my point of view, what this is saying to the industry is you will require a qualitative as well as a quantitative approach to developing investment strategies and making investment choices.
Yeah, you know, absolutely. I mean, when you have so much momentum, regulators, trade bodies that recognize that it's going to require a collected effort of all participants in the marketplace to move in a more sustainable direction. You know, when you're at that point, it throws open lots of investment opportunities and throws up risks to manage as well. So from our point of view, from an investment approach, you know, look, from a credit point of view, obviously credit risk is the key risk. But we don't really see a separation from ESG risks and credit risk. ESG factors have an impact on cash flows and therefore enterprise value, and therefore credit risk. And so for us, the companies that have an understanding of the regulation, have an understanding of where directionally companies have to move to do their part into building a more sustainable world, it's those companies, those leaders at the vanguard that we're most interested in on the one hand. On the other hand, we're also interested in those companies that have both the willingness and the ability to retool their business to adjust to the changing world. So they might not be the leaders now, but through dialogue and engagement, through the way they behave, products that they produce are clearly looking ahead, looking to build a sustainable business, which is to say not to forsake future cash flows for the benefits today. Looking at that, looking at it from a business point of view, those companies that are thinking ahead are the ones that could see the risk premium decline as they anticipate changes in regulation and the impact of, say, for example, climate change. And obviously, from a risk management point of view, it's about those companies that aren't focused on this, are not thinking from a long-term perspective what this could mean. Obviously, this prospect of for banks and the capital costs associated with it is something we're going to be watching very closely. So that's, I think that wraps up the discussion. Thank you very much. Until next time, I'm Mitch Resnick, co-head of credit at Hermes and head of credit research. Thank you, Ingrid Holmes, and thank you for listening to Amplified.
Thank you for listening to the Hermes podcast. If you found it interesting and would like to listen to more podcasts by Hermes, please visit our website, hermes-investment.com. and search for podcasts. These podcasts are for information purposes only, and the views, information, or opinions expressed therein are solely those of the individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of Hermes Investment Management and its employees. Performance should not be relied upon as a basis for investment decisions. All the performance represented is historical. Past performance is not a reliable indicator of future results, and investors may not recover the full amount invested.